John chapter 2 is going to be our study tonight. Give you a moment to turn to it. The second chapter of John, the first 11 verses. As soon as you find it, you'll recognize immediately that it's a familiar text. It's the account by John of the first miracle of Jesus, which was performed in Cana of Galilee, the turning of water into wine. Now, I'm going to study this with you. I want to begin, however, with verse 11. Start at the end, because verse 11 is the summary verse. Verse 11, as it's divided in the English Bible, sort of tells us what we were supposed to have learned by the time we've read that far. And so what we're going to do is we're going to sneak a peek to the end of this part of his essay, and see what we're supposed to have learned and use that as a guideline as we go through the text to make sure that we don't miss anything. Did you all get that? That's why I'm starting at the end. Not that you care, but he starts out, this beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, the first word we see there is that this is the beginning. This was his first miracle. Isn't any doubt about that? In the Roman church, there's a whole body of literature which has Jesus performing miracles as a child. These were written in the 2nd and 3rd centuries for the most part. They come from northern Africa for the most part. You know, one of the reasons, and not certainly not the best reason, but one of the many reasons I believe that the New Testament is inspired, and I'm speaking now in particular about the gospel narratives, is not only their brevity, but their selection of material. If you ever read a life of Lincoln, for instance, a very small life of Lincoln, is several volumes, and written by men who just thought Lincoln was a great man. And these biographies were written by men who thought Jesus was the Son of God, and they were right about that. Why would they leave out so much? Clearly, men writing under their own volition would have never left out the years when he was a child. We only have the one glimpse. It comes back from Egypt. We have the glimpse when he's 12 years old in the temple, and then silence until he begins his public ministry roughly at the age of 30. Well, many early Christians could not forgive the gospel writers for that omission, so they helped them out, and they made up stories. Stories that had Jesus playing down by the creek and making birds out of clay and throwing them up in the air, and they become live birds and fly away. A playmate falls off the roof and is killed, and Jesus raises him from the dead. But the church, the historic church, never accepted those. They have never been accepted officially, even by the Roman church, because we know they are not true. And if we did not had any other information, we would have the information in the New Testament itself. Because it's very clear that when Jesus begins to perform miracles, he amazes even those in his hometown of Nazareth. Is this not the carpenter's son? We've never seen anything like this before. And so this was the beginning of his signs. Now that's the biblical word, signs. The word miracles is a Latin word which came into use somewhat later. But there's a difference, and I pause here, and I'm going to say a few things here, and then we're going to hearken back to this when we come through the text. But there is a difference, there's a gap between the biblical concept of sign and wonder and the modern concept of miracle. There isn't anything wrong with the word miracle. We use it all the time. I use it all the time. But the word miracle must be understood within the context, within the framework of the biblical definition of signs and wonders. Now, to be a biblical sign has two characteristics which make it a sign. Number one, it is a self-evident miracle. That never has to be explained. I went to a faith healing meeting one time, and I sat in the back row, and the preacher up front told me all kinds of things I was seeing. Brother, I squinted, and I looked hard, and I didn't see what he was telling me I was seeing. But he assured me that it was there. Well, you see, a miracle is self-evident, like a sign. We can use the analogy of a road sign. It is self-evident. It explains its own presence. It is manifestly obvious. And the miracles of the Bible are truly that. And secondly, a sign never exists for itself. A sign, as the English word suggests, points to something other than itself. You got that? Biblical signs are, number one, self-evident. It's obvious to everyone that they're really miracles. And secondly, they point to something other than themselves. That is, miracles are never performed in the Bible just for the sake of performing miracles. You find that in the ancient Oriental mythology, literature which is contemporary to the biblical documents, where you have miracles which are performed just as show, as unconnected, purposeless sideshows. You don't find that in the Bible. God is very parsimonious with his miracles. I learned that word yesterday and he wanted to use it. He's cheap with his miracles. He gives them begrudgingly, and we're going to come back to that in just a moment. And miracles never exist for their own for themselves, but they point to something else. Now we know exactly what the miracles of Jesus point to. John tells us at the end of his gospel when he said, many other things Jesus did, which were not written in this book, but these have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and believing have life in his name. And where miracles did not fit that, where miracles did not perform the function of pointing to something other than themselves, then they were not performed. For instance, the apostolic miracles, whether they were performed by the apostles or by those upon whom the apostles laid their hands, they were never done for their own sake. They pointed to the apostles as God's official spokesman. They were the credentials which gave apostolic authority to the apostles and those upon whom the apostles laid their hands, that is, those who were identified with the apostles by the laying on of apostolic hands. And where those miracles were not performed, where that purpose was not met, the miracles were not performed. Example, Paul, as you know, you might read in Acts chapter 19 where Paul healed everyone who came to him. In fact, he could even heal those who couldn't get to him. They would take cloth, pieces of cloth from his body and take it to those who couldn't get there because of the crowd, and they would be healed. He healed everyone. And yet we know that Paul himself was sick. If you just read the account of Paul's life, just the material in the New Testament, and Paul was the sickest fellow that you ever saw. Read about all the times he had to change his plans and stay in a town he didn't want to stay in, or go somewhere he didn't want to go because of his sickness, his eyes and at least, and perhaps other sickness. That's why on his second missionary tour, he picked up a doctor at Troas. His name was Luke, to travel with him because he could not travel without his physician. And he asked to be healed, and God said no. Look at Trophimus and Epaphroditus. Trophimus, who almost died, and Epaphroditus had to be left behind because he was sick. And Paul had to write to Timothy and say to Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake and for your oft infirmities. Note this, that Paul was sick, and Epaphroditus was sick, and Trophimus was sick, and Timothy was sick. Of course, that was before oral came along. But even considering that, my, why would Paul write to Timothy to take one of these examples and say to Timothy, you're sick all the time, so go ahead, you can have a little wine for your stomach's sake. Why didn't he say, claim your healing? Why didn't he heal him? The answer is that the miracle would not have performed that function. Paul only healed when the miracles were needed to point to his apostolic authority, and when that function was not performed, the miracles were not performed. Now, so signs are you got that? Biblical signs are, number one, self-evident. Number two, they point to something other than themselves. They never are self-existent in purpose. Now, one more word before we leave the subject. And by the way, I'm not going to spend that much time on every word in the text. We will be home before breakfast. I know people get kind of panicky because we're just through the third word or fourth word in the text, and here we still are. I could tell you were worrying, weren't you? My goodness. She wasn't. I'm just trying to humiliate her. The word miracle today is used in the popular way to suggest everything that God does, and that's very confusing. This is not a big point with me. I would not sit up all night and argue with somebody over it, and nor would I even turn red in the face over it. But I think it is important enough to be said. It's very popular today to refer to anything that God does as a miracle. You know, you have a beautiful sunrise, and it's a miracle. A beautiful sunset is a miracle. The birth of a baby is called a miracle. We had a commercial that ran, still running, down in Orlando, Florida, when a baby whale was born out at SeaWorld. Shamu had a baby, and they actually showed the birth on television, and it gave it's quite remarkable. And it showed the baby killer whale being born, and it gave the date and the hour, and it said a miracle happened. No, it wasn't. As far as I know, there was a papa whale. And if there was a papa whale, it wasn't a miracle. You see, now listen to me. God does many things through the natural order. And are they not works of God? Yes. Are they not marvelous? Yes. Are they miracles? No. No. See, if the birth of your baby is a miracle and the birth of my baby is a miracle, what do we call the birth of Mary's baby? You see, we've used up our language. And so many things are marvelous in the natural order, that God's creation, God's natural creation is astounding. But it's not. But things operate by the natural order and not miracles. Second area in which God operates in a very direct way, we generally call providence. That's a good term. You ever have a prayer answered?
Yes.
Somebody is sick, and we think they might not get well, and we pray for them, and they get well, and they make progress, and they go home back to the family. Is that an act of God?
It most certainly is. It's a miracle. No.
No. It is providence. Understand? When God acts through providence, it is very much the work of God, but it is not a miracle in the biblical sense. You see, miracles in the biblical sense, signs and wonders, are very specific things, very self-evident. They are very particular things for very particular reasons, and that's what we read about. Now, I'm going to leave that. It says Jesus did, the beginning of his miracles, signs is the word, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and I'm going to come back to Cana a little bit later, and manifested his glory. It manifested his glory. Now, the word glory in the original language does not have an equivalent, an equal, in the English language. The closest word we have to it is the word character. It said this miracle manifested or made clear, made evident, his what? His glory. Now, in the Greek mind, and the language reflects this, the language of the New Testament reflects this, when they spoke of a man's glory, here's what they meant by it. When you're with someone, and you hear them speak, you see how they act, you come to know what kind of person they are, then they thought in terms of some kind of emanations that come from that person to you to let you know what kind of person you're with, who they are and what they're like. Got that? Who they are and what they're like. And this, with this impression you got from them, this knowledge you gained of them, was called their glory. And what John is saying is that the disciples witnessed this, and it manifested his glory. That is, it made evident to them who Jesus was and what he was like. Okay? His character, and his disciples believed in him. Now, question. As we go through this text, what in the text, what are we going to read about the turning of water into wine at Cana of Galilee, which makes evident to us that which the disciples saw? What will we see that will manifest the identity of Jesus and his character, who he is and what he is like? You understand? And so to follow John's own guidelines, we're going to look for that as we go through this account and look at the miracles. Now we begin on the third day. Verse 1 of chapter 2, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Well, now, this was a wedding, and the word wedding doesn't mean a wedding ceremony. There was no religious wedding ceremony. The ceremony itself consisted mainly of a man going to his bride's home and taking her to his house, and his friends went with him. But involved in this was a feast. The feast would often last several days. It was kind of a running buffet. I know I was a little boy growing up in Lawrence County, Indiana, and I come from a big family. Every time you shake a bush back there, somebody falls out that I'm related to or is looking for me. And all the aunts and uncles and the cousins would go to Grandma and Grandpa Chambers on Sunday afternoon, and they had this big round farm table, and some came for lunch and some came after, but there was food, and they just put a big tablecloth over it to keep the flies off. And you were expected when you came in to go to the table before you left. It was a great insult to my grandparents if you left without going to the table and pulling back the white tablecloth and having something to eat. Well, that was much like what these weddings were. They had a table and they had sort of a running feast, and people came and went. The relatives, friends came and went, and they would eat while they were there. And they didn't all get there at the same time. It lasted some days. It was in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now we conclude from this that this was, and we're very sure about this, that this, who the bride and groom were, we do not know, but they were relatives of Jesus, kinfolk. And it says, Jesus also was invited, and his disciples, to the wedding, and he came. Now, a word or two about this. I'll just say this in parenthesis, that Jesus, I think it is beautiful, if not significant, that Jesus performed his first miracle at a wedding. Jesus is for weddings, always has been. And here we see his character manifested. You see, we believe, do we not, as the disciples believed, as John records in verse 11, that Jesus of Nazareth is indeed the Son of God, but not just any God, but he is the Son of God, Son of the God of the Bible, the God of Genesis. And so when we read in Genesis that it was God, as we noted Sunday morning in the Bible school hour, who decreed that it was not good for a man to be alone, And that he brought the woman to the man, and he created marriage and said that for this cause the man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his own wife, and the two shall become one flesh. It is therefore, we are comfortable, we are not surprised, are we, to find when this God became human flesh, came in human flesh, when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, we see him at a wedding. He is for, and by the way, Jesus is still for weddings, so am I. Now, the modern world is for living together, but Jesus is for weddings. Now, the Mormons teach that it was his wedding. He had several wives, and this is one of his weddings in which he got some of his wives, but that's not true. It wasn't his wedding. I just thought I'd tell you that. Not that you thought it was, but I just thought I would say that. And it says his disciples came. What were they doing there? Were they related to him? Well, a couple of them were, probably. A couple of the disciples were Jesus' cousins. The rest of them weren't. Well, that was kind of strange. You know, it's not very nice, you know, to go to a wedding and bring along all your friends if they're not invited. Well, now, Jesus was not violating the protocol of the first century when his disciples came. You see, what Jesus brought with him was his college. A lot of misunderstanding about this, what was going on with Jesus and his disciples. I heard a preacher one time on the radio boasting the fact, he was boasting in his own ignorance, and he said, you know, you don't have to go to college to be a preacher, and he's quite right about that. I know some excellent preachers, never been to college. But he said, and then he said, well, of course, and he gave it his proof, the fact that the disciples of Jesus never went to college. Well, there he missed it. You see, they did go to college. They didn't call it college in those days. They did not have campuses in those days. But in the ancient world, Greek and Roman and Jewish, the way you went to college was you simply found a teacher. He became your rabbi if you were a Jew. And you made an arrangement with him, and you would live with him for part of the year. You would travel with him. If he went somewhere, you'd eat at the same table, sleep at the same roof. And Aristotle called it the peripatetic method, which means to walk around. You see, when Jesus got together his disciples, he established a college. And I read a book by a liberal one time said, well, you know, the Gospels contradict themselves. They give contradicting accounts, for example, he said, of the call of the disciples. Well, the poor fellow didn't realize that Jesus, there's no contradiction because Jesus called his disciples several times. See, they would meet and they would travel for a while and until they got wore out and ran out of money, and then he'd need a rest and he'd send them back and they'd go fish. Peter'd go fishing, get some money in the bank and take care of business back home, and then he'd go round them up again. Say it's time for the second semester. And Jesus, this is the freshman year, we know from the chronology here. And these are freshmen. So Jesus came with 12 freshmen. Which is why they ran out of wine. you ever try to feed Bible college freshmen? I mean, they can eat. But you see, it was. But while the school was in session, they were a part of Jesus. Understand? That was his. He had taken that responsibility as their teacher. And while they were with him, while school was in session, if you invited him, you invited them. So they were invited. That was the way you did it. Jesus came and his disciples. Now the drama picks up, and they ran out of wine. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Now, she was from southern Galilee, no doubt, being a genteel southern lady who never takes the direct approach. My mother-in-law, who was from Minnesota, southern Minnesota, she was like this, a great lady, and I miss her much. But she was raised in that genteel age when you never didn't ask the thing directly. You know, if she wanted to pass the jelly, she would never say, well, would you pass the jelly? She'd say, did someone say there was some jelly on the table? And you were supposed to translate that, and that means pass the jelly. And here the mother of Jesus, she says to him, we're out of wine. Very embarrassing. Your fault about these students. Now, what was she getting at? Do we have to guess? We absolutely do not have to guess. We know exactly what she was getting at because of Jesus' reaction to her. Now, why would she do this? Now, what I'm going to give you now, I can't prove, so it's a good thing I'm right about it. why Mary approached him on this, at this place, now? Well, I'm going to tell you what I think, and it doesn't mean I'm right about it. You listen to what I say and take it for what you think it's worth. But I think Mary, I'm going to tell you why I think Mary, at this time, at this place, ask him to perform a miracle. Understand? This is what she's asking him to do. So I say because we know, to repeat myself, because of his reaction, his response to her. Now, let me explain this by asking you a question. You see, 30 years before this, Joseph had been engaged to Mary, and he was just about ready to divorce her, that is, to break the engagement, and he didn't, and Mary had a baby. And I don't know how many beyond the immediate family Mary told about the conception by the Holy Spirit, but among those that she told, how many of you think believed her? You say, what, Mary? Oh, yes, Mary, yeah. Did the brothers of Jesus believe? We know that the brothers of Jesus became believers after the resurrection. Now, if they had believed that story, they would have been believers long before the resurrection. Would you agree with that? Now, Mary had been suffering for a long time. Psalm 69, we know the last part of Psalm 69 is messianic. Perhaps the first part is too. The first part of Psalm 69 is messianic or not, the words certainly fit the heart, the situation with Mary and Jesus. Verse 7 begins, "Because for thy sake, that is for the sake of God, I have borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face." What do you think the relatives have been saying about Mary and about Jesus all these years? "I have become estranged from my brothers." I just talked about that. "An alien to my mother's sons. For zeal for thy house has consumed me." That is, God, I've suffered this humiliation for you. "And the reproaches of those who reproach thee have fallen on me. When I wept in my soul with fasting, it became my reproach. When I made sackcloth my clothing." You know, have you ever been accused of something you were not guilty of, but you couldn't prove it? I'll tell you, it's very hard to be thought guilty of something when you're innocent, isn't it? It's hard to take. Verse 11 continues, "I became a byword to them." There's a name for people like Mary and Jesus. "Those who sit in the gate talk about me." Translated into the modern terms, we would say, down at the courthouse, they've been talking about me all these years. And I am the song of the drunkards. If they talked about Mary down at the courthouse, what do you think they said down at the bar? And her relatives. And listen, you see, they're all here. They all came to the wedding. All the aunts and uncles have been whispering and nodding and saying, yes, yeah, you heard Mary's story. Oh, yeah, I heard it too. They're all here. Note the combination. They're all here, and Jesus has begun his public ministry. Mary knows that Jesus is about to manifest himself. You got that? See, Jesus, this is the early part of Jesus' ministry. He has been baptized. He has been announced by John. He has had the temptation in the wilderness. He has gathered his disciples. He's about to make known what she has. Understand? Jesus is about to make known to everyone what she has known for 30 years. And I am convinced, and this is my opinion, my interest, I think that Mary is saying to Jesus, you're going to begin now to manifest yourself, to make it known. This would sure be a good place to get started. Why? Well, Aunt Minnie's here and Uncle Joe and you know, my second cousin who's a big snot, and they've been talking about me all these years. This would be a good time. Now hear me, this would be a good time, Jesus, to set the record straight. Now, that's an opinion. Jesus said to her, "Woman," and now that's the exact translation of it, but that would be a term of disrespect in our idiom. I like what the New International Version does here, uses the phrase, "Dear lady." That translates the idea. He was not speaking to her with contempt. He said to her, as we would say, "Dear lady, what have I to do with you?"
Literally, it says in the original language, what to me and to you, which means, what is there between us that makes you think you have a right to ask me to do this? And it's a rhetorical question. That is, the answer is assumed. That is, Jesus is saying, you know, don't you, that there is nothing between us, even though you're my mother, there is nothing that gives you the right to tell me to do this. And he said that, I think that is providential. I think he said that for the ages. See, Mary, one of the prophecies was that Mary would be honored by all generations, and she certainly is. As a matter of fact, I think Mary is not honored enough. I think we have reacted, we in the non-Catholic world have reacted against Mariolatry to the point where we have ignored Mary, who was one of the great people of all history. But even having said that, Mary is not the Queen of Heaven. She does not give orders to the Son, and he makes that very clear, that you have no right to ask me this. But she does not give up. And here we see Jesus as the Son of Man. Remember, we said this manifests his glory. We see his character in the fact that he came to the wedding. And here we're going to see the character of Jesus, his glory manifested again, in that even though he has said to her, my hour has not yet come, which means this is not what I had decided upon, this is not my original plan, he does it anyway. He vindicates his mother. He does what she asked. Not making it clear, he's doing it not because she has any authority over him. Doesn't that tell you something about Jesus? About his personal concern? He would change his kingdom plans for his mother. And she doesn't give up. She says to the servants, whatever he says to you to do, do it. I like that. That's a woman. I tell you, these accounts are accurate. You ever notice, fellas, how your wife can say no without saying no? You know how your wife can just agree with you at the same time she's ignoring you? You ever notice that? Every married man knows that. It's a very highly refined art, and I admire it. I can't do it, but I'm too honest. But he, in effect, says, then he changes his mind. But she says to the servants, and they're out in the kitchen, if he says he tells you to do anything, you go ahead and do it, just in case. I love that, the subtle approach. I've got a beautiful wife and two beautiful daughters. They've been working on me that way for 20 years, 26 years, got my wife. I mean, I can just stomp in and lay. Did you ever put your foot down and have it stepped on? I mean, I can't tell you how many times I have laid the law down, and there it laid. Why? Man, I would make my Jehovistic pronouncements from Mount Sinai. I would declare the law of the Medes and the Persians that cannot be changed. And then some beautiful blonde would look up to me, give me those eyes. And they didn't call me, I earned the term Mr. Softy. Kind of ashamed of that. And Mary says, in case he should tell you to do anything, you go ahead and do it. By the way, that's the only commandment ever recorded the mother of Jesus ever gave anybody. That's on record. You want to have a revival here at Monroeville? There's our revival. Think of the trouble we would save ourselves in our homes and in the church. And think of the difference it would make in our homes and in our church if we just obeyed the only commandment the mother of Jesus ever gave. Whatever he says to do, do it. I mean, we negotiate and vote and temporize and rationalize when he has spoken very clearly. You see, this is the spirit of modern Christianity, and we're a part of the problem. I hope we try to be a part of the solution. But the modern Christianity moves by the power of emotion too much. We do what we get in high gear for God if we get emotionally worked up to it. But hear me, true Christianity is a matter of simple obedience. He said to do it. Do it. Now, there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. Now, these were large jars for washing, for Jewish ceremonial washing, and they were reservoirs. The Jews did not wash their hands in these jars. Water was poured from them into basins. And for other things, for cooking. Understand? It was like it was just like having the pump in the house. When I didn't have a pump, they would fill the water jars. And you see this. You indicate that they had made provisions. There were six of them there. They had probably brought in extra ones for the wedding. That's a large number. And they were there, and Jesus said to them, "Fill the pots with water," and they filled them up to the brim. Now, let me give you a brief parenthetical study to tie up a loose end on as we discuss this very important miracle of turning water into wine. Because of the deadly pestilence that alcohol and liquor is upon our culture and upon our spiritual lives, even upon the church, I feel obligated to do a little teaching here, which you probably don't need, but maybe there's one person here that does need it, so I'll give it anyway. Because, you know, we in our English language, when we say wine, we mean a fermented beverage. If we want to indicate the fruit of the grape juice or any other kind of fruit juice, which is not fermented, we use some other term, do we not? Now, that has misled many people who, when they read the English word in the English Bible, the word wine, they assume it means a beverage of high fermentation, because that's what it means in English. But that is not what it means in Greek. In Greek, the word wine, and the word is oinos, and our word wine is the same word. It's just been translated to two or three languages. It's the same word. And that word was applied to any beverage made of any fruit, regardless of the level of fermentation. You got that? Any beverage made of any fruit, regardless of the level of fermentation, was called wine. So you cannot tell by seeing the word itself whether it is of high fermentation or low or negligible or non-existent fermentation. You have to depend upon the context to tell you what it is. Now, when they made wine in those days, and when the crop came in, they would have the new wine, the fresh grape juice. And then they would, in order to have it for the year round, they would boil it down to a concentrate, and they would hermetically seal it. On the floor of the Aegean Sea, there have been found amphora, Greek jars, which were there because of shipwrecks that took place before the time of Christ, containing this concentrate of wine, which was still drinkable. They could still use it. It wasn't very good, but they could still use it. They would seal them. Now, here came the trick. If you were a drinking person, we would call a drinker, they would let it ferment before they sealed it. If you were a sober person, you'd just seal it up, and the level of fermentation would be so low as to be negligible. And then when it came time to drink it, they would bring in a bowl called a crater. The crater of a volcano is the bowl of it. They bring in the crater, the bowl, and they would mix. They would bring the wine and the water. And then they would mix the concentrate with the water. And the concentrate, before it was mixed with water, was called wine. And after they mixed it, the mixture was called wine. And it was called wine no matter how you mixed it. And again, if people who were drinking people, they would put a whole lot of the concentrate and very little water, or no water and all concentrate. People who were sober people would simply mix it in such a way that the alcoholic content, and you understand there's a difference between alcohol, the level of alcohol you get with fermentation as opposed to the level you get with distilled beverages. Those are two separate animals. But anyway, they would mix it in such a way, if they were sober people, so that the level of alcohol was so low as to be negligible if they were sober people or anything in between. Understand? It's all wine. For instance, in the ancient world, if you mixed, the normal was, if you were just a normal person, you'd mix it 3:1. 3 parts water, 1 part concentrate. We know this from the ancient records. Now, if you were a teetotaler, you'd mix it a lot more water, less wine. The Scythians, who were the ancestors of the modern Russians, they were the hillbillies, lived up north, in the ancient world, they drank theirs neat. I mean, they didn't use any water at all. In the ancient world, if you were a drunkard, they said, "Well, you're a Scythian. You drink like a Scythian. You just drink it straight." You understand? They had all wine and no water. And I think it's significant that Jesus started with all water and no wine. Now, he says, "Fill it up to the brim." Why? This is going to be a self-evident miracle. No room for chicanery. No tricking here. No illusion. No sleight of hand. Fill it up to the brim. Now, let me ask a question. And you already know the answer, but I have a point in asking it. Where did Jesus perform his first miracle? Jesus performed his first miracle in Cana of Galilee. If you had been writing the script for the ministry of Jesus, where would you have had him perform his first miracle? Satan tried to write the script for Jesus during the 40 days of temptation, did he not? Where did Satan try to get Jesus to perform his first miracle? In the temple at rush hour. Cast yourself down at the last second. The angels will bear you up. Save your life. Man, you'll just impress the socks off of everybody. What a beginning. I point, it is significant. It is theologically significant that Jesus did not perform his first miracle in the temple. He didn't even perform his first miracle in Jerusalem. He didn't even perform his first miracle in Judea, where most of the Jews were. He performed his first miracle up in Galilee, which was the Galilee of the Gentiles. The Jews were a small minority in Galilee. Remember the Gadarene demoniac and the swine which ran down to the water? I heard a preacher one time says, good enough for that Jew, should have been raising pigs anyway. Now, the problem with that is it wasn't the Jews, the Gentiles. And that's why Jesus, did not, in his public ministry, he said, I am not sent but except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Jesus did not go into the major city in Galilee, which was Tiberias. He went into the larger Jewish communities, Capernaum, Bethsaida, Chorazin. But note this, Jesus didn't even perform his miracle, so he performed it up in Galilee of the Gentiles. He didn't even perform his miracle in the main Jewish community in Galilee, where he made his headquarters, which was Capernaum, down by the Sea of Galilee. He performed it up in Cana, for Pete's sake. Now, I can appreciate this, because I'm from Cana. I'm from Heltonville, Indiana. One of the reasons I get excited about life, because when you're from Heltonville, you get excited about anything. Yeah. You don't go to Heltonville unless you're either lost or on the run from the law or you know somebody or related. I mean, it's the middle of nowhere. And I promise you this, that if Jesus had not performed his first miracle in Cana of Galilee, you and I, neither one, have ever heard of it. I mean, Hollywood would never have written the script this way. Of all the insignificant places to perform your first miracle. But listen, I'm not finished yet. Mary wanted him to perform the miracle so all these smart aleck relatives could see it. And where did he perform the first miracle? In the kitchen. It says here, when they drew the wine out and took it to the head waiter, it says in verse 9, when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine and did not know where it came from, and then John explains, the servants knew. So let's summarize the answer to this question. Where did Jesus perform his first miracle? Not in the temple at Jerusalem during rush hour, during the hour of prayer. He performed it up here in Cana, in the kitchen. Brother, it had to happen that way. Nobody would ever dream that up. The least he could have done is done out in the banquet hall where everybody could see it. Who saw his first miracle? A bunch of servants. Now, what point am I making? My point, and note this, he performed it privately in an out-of-the-way place. Now hear me, Christian, and he did it reluctantly. What did he say to Mary? I don't really want to do this. He performed it privately, more or less privately. Didn't know to do all his miracles that way. Why didn't Jesus go out into the banquet hall and say, hey, y'all better get back here in the kitchen. Don't want to mess this. You see, that's what he could have been one of these modern preachers. Come see a miracle. That's what he'd have done. My point is this. Jesus did not only perform this miracle reluctantly. Jesus performed every miracle that he ever performed reluctantly. Why? Flip over to John chapter 4, beginning with verse 46, and we're back in Cana a few weeks later. John 4, 46. And he came therefore again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and was requesting him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Jesus therefore said to him, unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. He condemns him. Now, let me point out that Jesus, it's recorded in Matthew chapter 12, it's recorded in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus said, "It is a wicked and adulterous generation that seeks after signs." In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, I'm sorry, chapter 1, Paul says, "We preach Christ, to the Greeks foolishness, to the Jews a stumbling block." Why? Because the Greeks want wisdom and the Jews want a sign. And hear me, sign seeking will always be a stumbling block to those who do not believe in New Testament Christianity. It is still a wicked and adulterous generation that seeks after signs. Why? Well, let me take the liberty because of time and let me exploit the trust that you may have in me and not force me to go into a study that would take several hours. Let me summarize why it is a wicked and adulterous generation that seeks after signs. As we see when Jesus performed miracles, when he refused to perform miracles, why he performed them, the teaching that was attached to the miracles, here is the pattern that emerges. That Jesus performed miracles to prove he was the Son of God, but it was not the primary proof. The primary proof that he offered as he was the Son of God was the Scriptures. And he made it very clear that those who did not believe the Scriptures were acting in unbelief. He condescended to perform miracles sometimes, but hear me, after he had performed miracles, and the people had seen the miracles that he performed, and the evidence was sufficient, the evidence was sufficient to establish his identity, when they continued asking for miracles, he condemned it as unbelief. Why? You see, if the purpose of the miracles, as John clearly says, was to not just to make sick folks well and blind people seeing and dead people alive, but if the purpose of the miracles was to identify Jesus as the Son of God, to verify the claims that he was making about himself, if that was the purpose of the miracles, and he performed these self-evident miracles, when people asked for more miracles, it could only be because they did not believe. You got that? It was a sign of unbelief. That is why he condemns sometimes and commends sometimes. He said, "Your faith has made you whole. I have not seen such great faith, no, not in Israel." Commendations. In John 4, a condemnation. Remember after the second feeding of the multitude, they came wanting more and he condemned them. "Show us a miracle." Oh no. It says he could not perform his mightiest miracles in Nazareth, his hometown. Say that he laid his hands on a few sick folks and healed them. Why? Because did Jesus need the permission of the people of Nazareth to perform miracles? No. Did he need their faith? No. Jesus did not need the permissive faith of the Nazarethites to perform miracles any more than he needed the permission of the Sea of Galilee to walk on it. He did not perform any great miracles there because he was simply fueling their unbelief. Nazareth is the only place that we know of besides Jerusalem. Well, they tried to kill him. Thank you. Did you hear me on that last one? You see, the miracles, if a man did not believe when he had sufficient evidence, further miracles just made him mad. I would point out that the Pharisees saw the miracles and saw the miracles and saw the miracles, and finally he said, "You do it by the power of Satan." Did not make believers out of them. And it still stands today. It is still a sign-seeking is still a stumbling block to New Testament Christianity. Come see a miracle. No. Have I made that clear? If you're still seeking miracles, to find them. See, there's a word going around today in popular Christianity, TV Christianity, which says this, "Brother, you know, I believe if we had more faith, we'd have more miracles." Ever heard that? It's not true. It's not biblical. The New Testament teaching is, if we had more faith, we would not seek miracles. Because the miracles were to prove what we're supposed to already believe. So I'm not surprised that he performed his first miracle reluctantly, in the kitchen,
in Cana,
taking a little bit of bread and feeding many. We've seen him do that before. Took a small seed, and it multiplies itself 10, 60, 100-fold and feeds many. When we see him curse the fig tree, that is a promise of what he's about to do. We understand that he who cursed the fig tree because of its fruitlessness shall someday curse the whole world for the very same reason. And when Jesus healed, we see him as the Creator. When we see him raise Lazarus from the dead, we see him as the one who said, "Let there be life." We do not see Zeus or Ahura Mazda or any of that countless pantheon of pagan deities in flesh. We see Elohim, the God of Israel, God Almighty, El Shaddai. That's the God we see. And his glory, his character, his identity is manifested in this miracle. You see, it's no surprise. He who took water and made it wine just took a shortcut. He's the God who worked out the way you could plant a vine and the rains would fall and the water would become wine. And we see his character in this. I love this. It says, "You've kept the good wine until now." Are you surprised? That's the very thing we would have expected had we thought about it. He says, "It's the best I've ever had." Well, is this not the God who, when he created the whole world, said what? It is good. You cannot see that now because sin has pitched its tent on the blasted field of man's lost estate, but it was good before we got a hold of it. It's good. The best. You see, all the miracles of Jesus were the best. They were the real thing. Let me again refer to the most common miracle and use this as an example, and I could multiply this and talk about the other kinds of miracles. But take the healing miracle. Many today claim that they're still healing today the way Jesus and the apostles healed. Are they? Absolutely not. Now, how did Jesus and the apostles heal? Jesus and the apostles healed instantaneously. They healed completely. They healed permanently. They healed an infinite variety of diseases, including raising the dead. They healed without failure. And they did not necessarily require faith on the part of the person being healed. Did you get that? If I can think of it, I'll give it to you again. Jesus and the apostles healed instantaneously, completely, permanently, an infinite variety of diseases, including raising the dead, without failure, and without necessarily requiring faith on the part of the person being healed. Has anybody done that since the age of the apostles? The answer is absolutely not. Nobody, even... I had a fellow tell me that one time. He said, "Well, we heal just like Jesus did." And I said, "Well, this is how they heal. This is how you heal." And he said, "Well, if you're going to define it that way, no." You know, if you're going to be sticky about it. Well, I said, "That's how Jesus did it. And until you can do it that way, don't put Jesus' name on it." You see, Satan is the fellow who fails. And men fail. Well, you see, when every time Jesus healed somebody alive, they didn't stumble around and spend 6 months in the ICU. I mean, they went home and fried chicken. Didn't they? When Peter at the Gate Beautiful healed a man for 40 years never walked, never had legs, he entered the high jump. He jumped. And when he made water into wine, it was the best. Why? It manifests his glory. How could Jesus of Nazareth, who is the Son of God, do anything less? Listen, men do that which is cheap and shoddy and second rate. But when God does something, it's the best. And when he gave his Son, he gave the best. That's how he does things. That's how he operates. That's who we're dealing with. Last thing I want to say is this. And I want to be careful that I do not spiritualize the text. And so I'm going to put it this way. When the head waiter says to the groom, "You saved the best until now," that reminds me of the fact that God often does that. God often saves the best for the last. I think of the whole New Testament teaching on the earnest of the Spirit. Now we have a little bit now, but you wait. You think it's great to be a Christian, to be a child of God now?
Brother, to let me use the language of the street, you ain't seen nothing yet. God saves the best to last.
And if you're not a Christian tonight, let me tell you about another marriage feast. There's not just one in the Bible. We've looked at one. There's others. We read in parables about the marriage feast that a king gave for his son. John in our text said that there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and Jesus and Mary, all the relatives, and Jesus' freshman class, they all got invited. There's going to be another one day, and we're invited. The invitation is recorded in Revelation chapter 19, verse 7 and following. Let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to Him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and His bride has made herself ready. And He has given to her to clothe herself in fine linen. That's us. See, we're the bride. We've been invited. For the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. On that great wedding feast that day, Jesus is going to be there too. And Mary. And the disciples. And we're going to be there. And I think we're going to say what the head waiter said. You saved the best till now. All things are ready. Come to the feast. Our invitation. Won't you respond? Let us help you to confess your faith and obey the gospel. Become a Christian tonight.